on the areas that are within our budget division. And we were going to start with early childhood development grants today, but Terrell Clark is going to be late, and I think she wants us to wait until she gets here. So we'll start with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and then at some point we'll interrupt you and go back to Senator Clark and then resume with you. So, Commissioner and your assistant.
Good morning, Senator. My name is Clark Dyrud. I'm Commissioner for Department of Veterans Affairs. And with me today is Gil Acevedo, the new Deputy Commissioner for Health Care. We are here for two items on the agenda. We will start with the bonding request for the veterans' homes. We do have some PowerPoint slides that will summarize what the bonding request is this year. And we can just start moving through those.
So why don't you just start with the ones that are included in the governor's budget?
Yes,
and then when you finish those, you can go through the others and just let us know when the others are beginning.
All right. Thank you, Chair. We will do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
And Madam Chair and Commissioner, are we going to be working off of this document here?
Senator, yes.
Okay.
Is someone going to run? We'll have that.
Oh, okay. So we will be working off of this document. We do not have it up here. So we can just start flipping back page one. Again, just the first page is just a summary. Effective the 19th of November 2007, Governor's executive order abolished the veterans' homes and placed the five state-run veterans' homes under Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Again, to recap, the fiscal year 06-07 operating budget, $130.9 million. And of that, 53% is appropriated by the state. 23% comes into the state from the federal government by way of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs per diems, and about 24% is resident pay. So that's kind of the quick overview. The next page just makes
clear. While you're on this topic, since you weren't involved in the discussions that we had with the board last year, we are interested in having the homes move toward being able to collect Medicare per diems, because we think we could have a larger share of federal funding financing the operation. And we don't need to talk about that in detail today, but I just wanted you to know that we've had those discussions in the past with the leadership of the previous board.
Chair Berglund, as I was ex officio on the long-term care commission that met from May through November, that point was raised also. The bottom line is, years ago it was either Medicare or VA per diems. That changed many years ago, but it has never been really reviewed by the board. That is absolutely on our list of things to do as we go forward, is to explore that. Why aren't we? How can we? I hate to give a timeline that we will have this completely reviewed and ready by X date. There's a lot going on, but that is absolutely on.
Well, there's no time like when you're short of money to find some new money.
We will be reviewing that. So don't. That is exactly one of the things we will do, and it was one of the recommendations of the Long Term Care Commission as well.
Madam Chair, Gil Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Health. The topic of Medicare billing is one of the items that I'm going to be looking at in the not-too-distant future. Next month, in March, we're going to start looking at the actual strategic plan, and that is one of the topics that we're going to start doing our research on. And I have some background and experience working with veterans homes and Medicare billing as well. So I'm going to definitely take a look at that, ma'am.
Well, keep us informed.
Yes, thank you.
The next slide shows very clearly the demarcation since the executive order. The organization chart, the block to kind of the lower right, it says Deputy Commissioner of Veterans Health Care. That is equivalent to the old Executive Director of the Vets Homes Board. So that kind of shows how the organization will be structured. So the five Veterans Homes Administrators would answer to the Deputy Commissioner. So Gail Acevedo is that Deputy Commissioner. I think you've seen his bio. He's run a veterans home in California for the last 7 years, and I think he's very much acquainted with a veterans home systems, and he is in charge of everything relating to the veterans homes. The other deputy commissioner is the deputy commissioner we've had for years, Mike Pugliese, and all of the programs and services of what used to be known as the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs will still be under that deputy commissioner. So the break is very, very neat. It's very clean. It comes right under the commissioner. And that, again, any explanation or more information you want, we are willing to share and talk about. The next slide, again, quickly summarizes your current homes, where they're located, the number of beds, and I think most of you are pretty familiar with that. That's kind of a four-year review slide. Then moving into the bonding, I think the first item we talk about is pretty standard. There's asset preservation in every bonding year. And this year, the request is $7 million for the department-wide asset preservation at all five facilities. It breaks out some of the general topics in Minneapolis, in Hastings, Laverne, Silver Bay, and Fergus Falls. So these are the standard asset preservation. Obviously, we have more detail if you would want them. I think we will just keep moving. If there are questions about anything, we will stop. The next page, now we start. The next two pages go together. It starts with $1 million to demolish Building 9 on the Minneapolis campus. By way of summary, as you see below, in October, we got the news that Building 9 was falling down, basically. The steel I-beams, vertical and horizontal, were rusting. The brick were porous that were put there in 1930, were somewhat porous, and over the years there had been an exchange of moisture. Gradually, the I-beams were rusting as time was passing. So this was discovered. They were doing a tuck point project. They removed some bricks, and one thing led to another, and it was considered a life safety issue, and there were 47 veterans that were moved out of the building. The building is vacant. The building was considered historical, but the main part that made it historical was the bricks. They were kind of a sandstone brick from the Depression era. And to replace the bricks does sort of negate the historical value of it. To inhabit it, you would have to replace the bricks. So it appears that the historical preservation aspect of that is not very high. In fact, it appears that they would allow it to be demolished since the bricks would be gone. Some of you have seen, it's just basically a rectangular building. It's not that, remember, some of you have seen that awesome Building 6, which was completely rebuilt, keeping the facade in the same way. But Building 9 would not be in that category. Since it is a life safety issue, what we are proposing in the next slide is to build a new 100-bed facility on that location. The request is for design, construction, and building of a 100-bed nursing care facility on Minneapolis campus. And it would be the new sort of pod-type design that is more or less state-of-the-art. A lot has been said about 1950-style nursing homes, and this would be the, as I said, the state-of-the-art. We would request $25.99 million for this project. at
Commissioner,
the end.
Usually when we build new buildings like this, we get federal funding.
Yes.
I see you're asking for 100% of the total project cost here.
Chair, we do get reimbursed 65% of that. There are two ways to proceed. One is to proceed with, 35% request for funding. Then it goes on the VA project list. Then each federal fiscal year, they have the project list. Depending on where you are, you go up or down, and then it eventually gets funding, and then you go, you proceed. When there are what they call life safety issues, they will allow projects to go to the top of the list. The main reason for doing the 100% up front is to start on the project immediately. You would have to, under the best case scenario, delay everything a year to even be considered, and then you go forward from there. So the main reason for doing the 100% up front is to start it right now. We have a situation where you have 50 domiciliary care people living on one floor of the nursing home care facility in building 17. And those are designed to be nursing home beds. So we have a situation of basically an emergent type need. The VA would reimburse 65% of it. So that is what we are requesting. We could move forward fairly quickly in response to an emergency situation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, then let's say we authorize this and then the department got reimbursed that 65%. Where does that, we've already did the bonds, then where does that money go? In the general fund or where? I don't know.
Senator Berglund.
Commissioner.
Senator Coring. Yes, it would go back to the general fund. Or a place to be designated in some of the language that would authorize bonding for this. But that's historically, we have been getting reimbursed. We've been doing projects and getting reimbursed for, repair projects, better, et cetera. In fact, that secretary from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs came and made a big presentation of a large check, $12 million to pay back the share of a project that had been done at Silver Bay. So,
well, what you need to understand is that our situation is we have about five times as many requests as we have bonding authorization. And so if we were to fund this project at 100%, fully understanding your difficult situation, there would be some other project that doesn't get funded. And so we have to look at it from both sides.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, this is the first time that I can recall that we have been apprised of building this new facility. And the last time, as I recall, that we heard from the board, they were talking to us about their desire and their intent to put together a strategic plan. And does this fit? What kind of assurance can you give us that this fits in with that strategic plan? I think a strategic plan is definitely in order and much needed, but I continue to be frustrated by what appears to me to be sort of various pieces that come at us at any particular given time. So maybe you'd like to clarify.
Madam Chair, Senator, the strategic plan is absolutely important, and I know that there have been several discussions and proposals and ideas as to how we're going to develop the strategic plan. My intent is that after our first meeting and have the minutes of the meeting and identifying the strategic direction that we need to go. And we're talking not only the future of the homes within the next 5-10 years, but we're also going to be talking about our building and building structure and how we're going to perform our care in the future. Those minutes I am going to bring to Senator Berglund just to keep the senator informed of what's going on, keeping the committee informed as well. One of the things that this plan that we're talking about is looking more at a culture change within nursing homes. And if you see the way it's proposed here with the pod structure, it's a smaller group where we have 16 residents and the care is given directly within those neighborhoods and those pods. So that's why we're looking at this particular model as compared to what we currently have.
So how many beds were in Building 9?
Senator Berglund, 61.
But we're replacing it with 100 beds?
Yes, Senator.
Because we're moving to community-based services?
Senator Berglund, just again to amplify Senator Lynch's request, the executive order moved the homes. It abolished the Veterans Homes Board, put it under the department November 19th. This building was falling down end of October. It was, I think, deer hunting season when people were moved out, you know. So these two things have happened simultaneously. One of the issues, there really has not been a strategic plan, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. So
I thought that's what the governor's commission was doing, was putting together a plan.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, the commission's report that we have gives us a direction. It gives us a roadmap, the initial roadmap. And it doesn't outline the strategic plan per se, but it does give us a good jumping point, a starting point. Why 100 beds? The need is going to be there as we look at the projections going out through the years. We want to provide a more resident-centered care. So it would be more, you know, getting a state-of-the-art facility in the Minneapolis campus would only, in my opinion, help and assist in performing that quality resident-centered care versus
we have been downsizing the nursing homes in the rest of the state.
Yes, ma'am. And one of the things that, Madam Chair, one of the things that the commission report identified is reaching out to those veterans and trying to see, look at ways that they can probably receive care at home or other than institutionalized. And that's all part of the discussion as well. How can we do that?
Well, what we found when we were doing this for the community at large is that when we started providing more community-based services, they were preferred, and we actually, not through any original plan, but we just saw people preferring community-based services, and we saw a decrease in the utilization of the nursing home beds, and then we saw a downsizing of the nursing home beds throughout the state.
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the things also that in our current setting in Minneapolis, we have four residents to one bathroom. So it's two residents sharing one room, two other residents sharing the other room with an adjoining bathroom. What I would love to see, and again, there's lots of discussion that needs to occur, is to make it so that a resident has a private room, has a privacy in that room. And so if we look at the numbers of our beds, and I'm just right now, there is no plan, so I'm just talking that this is the direction I would like to go. But once we start setting up our strategic plan and looking and doing the studies, that's where it's all going to come out. But a family member coming to visit their loved one in a room, the patient or resident-centered care for privacy would be far better if a resident had a private room so that the family can share time with them rather than in a room that's shared with another person.
Well, I wish you had a plan. I mean, I would much prefer you were sitting up there telling me you were going to build a 100-bed facility and you were going to downsize some of the beds in your older buildings.
I would, Madam Chair, I would love to be able to tell you that. Unfortunately, I haven't been here that long.
Well, you're the one asking for the bonding now.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, I would like to point out, however, that Fergus Falls has 85 nursing home beds. Laverne has 85, nursing home beds, Silver Bay 89, Minneapolis 349. If you look at the veterans population of roughly 400,000, you look at the number of nursing home beds, that is not a large number going into the future. In fact, it's way less, a lesser amount than the needs for nursing home going into the future. And we are talking about a program that the per diems from the VA is only for two programs, nursing home or domiciliary. The VA is not reimbursing for other, like assisted living or other of those programs. Now, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, as you say, looking down that path, that's brand, you know, that would be a new venture for the veterans' homes. But as a, currently as the veterans' homes exist, the only funding is for nursing home or domiciliary care. And looking into the future, we do not feel that the three, you know, the total number of nursing home beds, I think there will always be a need. For example, there's over 300 waiting list on the Minneapolis campus. There's a 75.
Right, but that is in part because that is the only service you provide.
Yes.
And Commissioner, I might just add that the testimony that you're giving me here today is why I'm so skeptical of the commission report. You can get out of the old rut because of the way the Veterans Administration funds your services. I will be amazed. Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, and I understand that the purpose of our discussion today is for this bonding request, but I would just offer for members as your evaluating this particular component of the proposal, we have heard repeatedly in this committee about staffing challenges for the existing facility and being able to serve the existing operations. And without a strategic plan, and I have some concerns that I'm not sure that those operational deficiencies are going to be readily addressed just by putting together a new facility. So I just offer that for members for their consideration.
Other questions? Okay, let's continue then.
All right. The next request is for $7.8 million for HVAC upgrade at Minneapolis campus. That would be Building 17. That is the 250-bed nursing home facility built in 1980 and is quite solid, but the HVAC is an issue. The primary season that this becomes an issue is summer, with the air conditioning part leaves residents at risk of dehydration. The air conditioning isn't working properly for nursing home patients. So the upgrade of the HVAC would be a key piece that would keep Building 17 in relatively great state. Now, we've talked earlier about no strategic plan as such. A strategic plan is a very specific document that is worked on in a very specific way, which hasn't been done. We've taken over since November. We may not have an official document called the strategic plan, but we do have a vision. We do have a vision. We know the history, and we are going forward. And if you look at that campus, Building 6 is an awesome building. It's been redone. It's 91 beds of Alzheimer's care in a historic setting. You have Building 17, which it's a solid building. It has 100 beds on two floors, 50 on another. You look at Building 9, which has fallen down. If you have a building, a 100-bed building there, you have the basis going into the future of something that can be taken in bite sizes, but there is a vision there. You could take 100 people from the second floor of Building 17, put them into the new building of 9. You could then reconfigure each floor in a more modern way or a more appropriate way. There is vision. We might not have a strategic plan, but we have vision, and we have had the homes effectively put under us for, 2 months now? I mean, I am very sorry we do not have a document like the strategic plan, but we are We understand some of the things that haven't taken place in the past, and we do have a vision for that. So I just want to point out, part of this, by upgrading the HVAC, Building 17 is a pretty solid, substantial. I'm not saying that it would never need any further work, but I mean it's a fairly solid building and in good shape.
So if you upgrade this HVAC system, you indicate that you would have reduced utility costs?
Yes.
And have you calculated what that savings would be?
No, ma'am.
I don't have it.
Maybe you could get that to us.
Yes.
Other questions about this?
And that, of course, I'm sorry.
No, I guess not.
Madam Chair, also just point out by that, of course, qualifies for the 65% federal match.
Does
also.
It go on a waiting list or?
That one, that is dependent on whether full funding is asked or the one-third share. There are two ways to do that.
And what is this amount?
This one is the that is the, this is the full amount to get the job done. So. That is what is in the governor's request for bonding. Again, the main part of that is the pardon me. Oh, I'm sorry. I slipped right past one here somewhere.
Silver Bay was before the HVAC.
Yes, okay. Silver Bay, I believe it was the last bonding year, a project, you know, the one-third match for a project in Silver Bay was passed. Time has passed. There is a $225,000 need for cost of living, et cetera, to keep the place in line for the federal match for that project. So $225,000 is for that renovation and existing space in Silver Bay.
So what's happened is the cost of the project has gone up while it's been on the waiting list.
Exactly.
At the federal level.
Exactly.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think that happens with the projects put on.
And how long do we think it'll be before it gets to the top of the list?
There is a large increase in the VA's budget that was just signed a month ago or very recently. There is a lot of excitement because it is believed that many of the projects will be covered. You know, there's this influx of money. So typically it could be a several-year waiting list. One of the things is that there within that list, there are things that reprioritize. That's why getting back to Building 9, since there's life safety issues, it shoots to a top of a list.
Right.
So that is, you know, there's an opportunity that can be grasped. So there are other projects that can knock people up and down the priority list. It is hoped that this year, with this large influx of money, that many of the projects will be picked up. No guarantees at this point.
Any questions about Silver Bay?
What's that? The 31.
Okay, let's go then.
Madam Chair, the Silver Bay project is number 31 on the project list. So the next question is how many of the projects are going to be granted. We're waiting to see. Then now we are to the additional bonding requests that were not included in the governor's initiatives. There's $6.65 million for supportive housing at Hastings. Hastings is a 200-bed facility domiciliary, and supportive housing is a transition between, as you well know, I'm not going to belabor that, but it's between the domiciliary care and completely independent living. There is a $9.9 million request for a Fergus Falls special care unit, you know, Alzheimer's dementia unit, 21-bed of special care for Fergus Falls. There's a request for Candy Ohio Veterans Home construction. That would be a new veterans home in Wilmer and a 90-bed facility. The pre-design was done on that two or three years ago.
I remember.
Pardon?
I remember.
Yes. So pre-design was done on this. Then we're looking for Minneapolis campus security, $2.3 million to install a fully developed and monitored security system. You know, used to go by the name of Wander Guard or something. It would allow a state-of-the-art ability to keep in track of, you know, residents with dementia, things of that nature. Then there was $11.3 million request for remodeling all 5 resident units in Building 17 and update the main kitchen and dining room. So, but the key, the really important one was the HVAC. That brings it, Building 17 I'm talking about, the real, that's a real high priority because there are potential issues with, you know, safety issues with the residents.
So in regard to the supportive housing, would that be eligible for federal matching dollars?
No.
Okay.
There are other programs there are other sources of funding for supportive housing we are looking at also. We are looking at a wide range of possibilities, but this would be state-funded.
Are there any questions about the items on the additional bonding request list? Yeah. Senator Pretner-Solon?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes of the meeting, but what is the full amount of the request from the Veterans Association?
The items that are on the pages, the full pages, those are in the governor's budget request.
42.
But as we were going through it, we were noting that the construction of the nursing home is at 100% request, and usually there's a 65% match of federal dollars. So the question would be whether we would choose to have it be funded at the 100% level or at the lower level. Other questions? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I'm confused. I thought you said 42 something, but the Silver Bay is 227.
227,000.
And with regard to Silver Bay, if that money is not allocated, what happens to Silver Bay on that list?
We would not receive, Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we would not receive the matching federal dollar that is already, we are on the project for. So that total project was, what was the total match or total project?
This is for this one here.
Total is, project is $5.3 million. It's the Silver Bay one.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you. I think we're going to take Senator Clark's proposal next, and then we'll come back to you to talk about the recent incident at Minneapolis Veterans Home. Is Senator Clark here? And Senator Clark, we are actually in possession of your bill, which we are not really going to act on. We are just going to send a letter to the Capital Investment Committee because we don't have most of the bills. And since if we were going to hear all the bills, they'd have to go through the full Finance Committee before they could go back to the Capital Investment Committee. My suggestion to you is that you get your bill re-referred.
Yes, Madam Chair, that was our intent. Well, thank you, members. Good morning and happy Valentine's Day. This particular proposal that's in front of you is something that has been a long-term component of the capital investment bills and investment in Minnesota's youngest children. It is a little different than most of the proposals that come before you or become before us because it is not about a specific proposal. What it is instead is it's a process in which communities come together and figure out how to be doing some type of a place that is having experiences for young children. Over time, it has broadened to try to have partnerships where you have you essentially can get more resources or more assistance towards your proposal if you have at least three types of programming that will be in or services that will be in the facility or the rooms or whatever it is that they are doing. And this is mostly for new members. I know the people who have been around a while know this. But so the hope is that you'll have a place where Head Start and perhaps child care or crisis nursery, ECFE, some of the other things that we're trying to do. Sometimes there's immigration and refugee services placed there. And a quick example from my area is the Boys and Girls Club. The city, the county, a number of other entities came together, and there's a place where there's Boys and Girls Club. There's some Parks and Rec kind of things, Head Start, crisis nursery, there are parenting classes, there's a variety of things that happen there. There's a number of things in your packet. Probably the thing that might be the most useful, though, to look at is this map that was put together. It shows about the statewideness of this. Local communities, again, put together their proposals, and there is an RFP that they respond to through the department. At this point in time, it's the Department of Human Services that administers this. Sometimes the projects are simple renovations. Sometimes they're complete facilities. But in a lot of ways, this money acts like yeast. It's what helps leverage other funds to be gotten. In a year where we know we're facing a deficit, but so many people keep trying to figure out how we can move forward on early childhood, facilities and the spaces are as important as it is in our higher education institutions. We know that it can make a huge difference. So I'm going to stop with my comments for right now. I've got two people here. We know that your time is precious, but I have Jerry Cutts and Steve Nagel here, and they can, from two different perspectives, talk about, give some information and talk a little bit about why this is so important. Thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Steve Nagel, and I'm with West Central Minnesota Community Action. We're located in Elbow Lake, Minnesota, and serve the counties of Douglas, Pope, Stevens, Traverse, and Grant. And I've been involved with four of these bonding projects over the years. The first three were in Monaga and Purim and Parker's Prairie. And they were among the smallest bonding grants. And we were fortunate that we were located relatively close to youth build projects, and in two of those projects, the youth build were actually the main contractor. The plumbing and electrical things were subbed out. The project that I wanted to talk about today was located in Browns Valley in Traverse County, and Traverse is the smallest county population wise in the state. And it's also the oldest. The average age in Traverse County is the oldest. And we built a new family service building in 1999 with one of these grants. And it had such an enormous impact on the town of Browns Valley. And Browns Valley is, you know, when you go down the western end, it's right on the tip of the bump. And before we built the building, we were sharing a storefront with the food shelf and the social services, and it was just difficult. It was really kind of pretty much a dilapidated building. It's been pretty much vacant since 99, and we had heating problems and really had struggles with rodents constantly. And when we got the grant to build this building, we succeeded in raising $111,000 to match it. Things really came together well for us. I have some pictures of this project if you're interested. It was before we had digital cameras. but one of the things that was difficult for us is that Browns Valley, Minnesota, was located over 100 miles from the nearest youth build project. So we had to put a youth build program together in order to do it, and it just didn't turn out like as we hoped. And we had a lot of trouble recruiting a licensed teacher to do it. And where we plan to start the project right in June and have the youth build program build the garage and do the internal wall framing. We weren't able to locate a teacher, so we didn't bring the youth on until late July. And at that time, we had to have another contractor do the part we had planned. And we ended up having the youth build. And it was difficult finding a teacher. Generally, we had some that were interested. But generally, out in that part of the state, the building trades teachers have other projects in the summer, and they just weren't interested. And what happened is the youth build did the sheetrocking in the project, and it really wasn't, and the taping and the painting, and it really wasn't satisfactory. We had to go back and do that again, and switching our contracts, it ended up adding $20,000 cost to the project in order to accommodate that. While that was difficult, it was really a very small small obstacle for us. The project turned out very, very well. I believe it was the first new building in the downtown Browns Valley in over 60 years, and it is now used. It houses the Head Start, Traverse County Public Health, and Social Services has a liaison there where with the Sisseton Wahpeton Band. They use that building as well. Last spring, when Browns Valley suffered a horrible flood, the Browns Valley Service Family Service Building housed the VISTA worker that coordinated the flood relief. The building's also used by Legal Services, and I think I mentioned the food shelf is located in the building. This is a project that would not have happened, and it was an area where we had a great need, and we certainly appreciate your help.
Senator Clark.
Madam Chair, just because I think some members may not be aware of the youth build requirement, one of the challenges over time that has appeared with this is for a very good reason. Representative Clark had made sure that there was a youth build requirement as part of the building of these facilities. And what has become a challenge over time is that even for the places that have a youth build component, it may or may not have the right skills to be doing one of these facilities. And one of the things that we'll be looking at as we move on is probably looking at softening that language to making it where feasible, because there are places in the state that just don't have it, and you want the young adults to have a very good experience, but that's why there could be a challenge, because a portion of it has to, under the current law, be done in conjunction with youth build. Mr. Cutts.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jerry Cutts. I'm the president and CEO of First Children's Finance. We're a nonprofit corporation, and we target public and private investments to drive the supply of high-quality early care and education. I'm honored to have the opportunity to talk with you about the importance of bonding for early care and education facilities. As you may recall, 10 years ago, the legislature passed a bill that led to the creation of a loan fund, which is a public-private partnership to finance child care facilities. We're pleased to report that the public funds leveraged private funds threefold, and this resulted in the creation or the improvement of more than 5,000 spaces for children in more than 200 sites so far. Those funds can't be used for public school facilities and some other public facilities. And so this is one of the reasons why the bonding bill is so important. To build public and private partnerships, we've assembled advisors and investors from the private sector, including representatives of banking, insurance, accounting, and law. We call this group the Children's Chamber of Commerce. This group has invested and advised our loan fund, our growth fund, and it's currently making recommendations about other public and private investments, including the bonding bill for child care facilities. Our Children's Chamber of Commerce establishes principles for investing in early care and education, and it strongly endorses these child care facility bonding because it fits three essential principles. I'd like to share those with you. First off, the public funds leverage private funds on at least a one-to-one basis. The principle is leverage. The second principle is incentivizing collaboration and quality. The public funds incentivize and reward collaborations on the local level, like collaborations between Head Start, child care, and public schools. The principle, again, is incentivizing collaboration and quality. And third, the public-private approach is potentially a sustainable approach that is capable of going to scale. It's not a scattershot approach. So the principle, the third principle, is sustainability and ability to go to scale. Madam Chair, at First Children's Finance, with our Children's Chamber of Commerce, we're prepared to bring business expertise to the table to make the bonding bill even more effective and efficient and to help leverage additional resources. Thank you.
Is there any requirement that the programming that will be in the buildings that are in this portion of the request, that they focus on family and children being active? One of the recommendations of the Healthcare Access Commission, our public health working group, was that there be more emphasis in the bonding bill on helping communities where there is there are fewer facilities for families to be active together in terms of improving our obesity rates in the state. Has there been any discussion about that, or is there any requirement that that be considered as a part of the application?
Madam Chair, one of the things that I really like about this approach of the bonding bill, inherent in it is the reward for collaborations and multi-service centers and partnerships, and those are the kinds of facilities that are community facilities that can create access for families, and I think that's a real strength of this bill.
And Madam Chair, to your question, there is not a specific requirement by its nature, because we're talking about services for young children. The facilities that are constructed include things like large muscle rooms. I mean, it's to help facilitate the activity, because we are talking about small children. They are designed to generate appropriate developmental physical activity experiences, because that's so important with what is being done. If you're asking specifically, is there a requirement or a stress that also relates to the parents, that may or may not be relevant for some of the services offered, because the parents may not be the ones actually doing it. I will look over the language as we're moving forward, though, and see if there's any other language that might facilitate. But I do want to reinforce that this is probably the one thing that specifically in the bonding bill that always generates additional physical activity and that part of wellness just by its nature, because those large muscle rooms
I'd really encourage that, and I'd encourage not only the focus on children, but the involvement of the children with their parents. We know one of the best examples we have so far in terms of the STEPS program that's been funded by the federal government through the Department of Health is down in Rochester, where they took families that were involved with WIC and gave them memberships and transportation to the Y and had them involved together in physical activities. And it's been a very successful program in reducing obesity among those families.
And, Madam Chair, I think certainly encouraging entities to do that's a good thing. It would also obviously require probably some additional resources on their part if we're talking about specifically exercise.
Well, we're hoping we get some for them this year.
That would be good.
But if these things can work together, because, you know, just like in Browns Valley, there are communities that, you know, they don't have the facility even to have the activity in the winter take place in.
And, Madam Chair, another example that you might want to think about to use for the future is the facility that is in, I think it's Prairie Island. Is that the, or is it North? No, it's not Northfield. Maybe it's Northfield, the Northfield Resource Center. They had partnered at the building. It has Head Start, and when there's enough child care resources, child care, they've got, so they have an early childhood wing. They have the Alternative Learning Center is based right there. It's right across the street from the high school. So they have that. They do ELL classes. They have a quote-unquote senior wing, but they built a pool within that. And because it is a multi-use facility, they also then, you have the kind of, I think, activity happening with families, with seniors, with others coming in and utilizing that space. So obviously in the long run, those are the kinds of projects that I think we'd all really want to see.
Right. Well, I know that the projects are awarded on a points basis, so if somehow we could build that into the criteria, I think it would help move us all in a in a direction we need to move for to have a healthier society in the future.
We've got the department here, and I will talk to them about that as well.
Other questions, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Senator Clark, just a comment, actually, and I just want to commend Senator Clark for bringing this forward. The appropriation last time was $500,000, and I appreciate your work in this area and think that it does a lot to seek to really move the state forward.
And thank you, Senator Lynch. Madam Chair, I think the other piece with this is you can see how the appropriation has expanded and contracted. And frankly, what happened after the 2003 budget cuts is that for many communities, them being able to offer the services that were really needed by families was cut back or curtailed in some cases. And so the last couple of requests and certainly appropriations were smaller because then the focus ended up being on renovating, getting rid of asbestos, you know, health kinds of things. But we're back at a point now where we, and the emphasis that we're having as a legislature about what can we actually do to help close that achievement gap, among other things, that there are a number of communities that have both rebounded and have also understood the importance of the investment. And so that's why we're here back with a higher request. Thank
you. Other questions? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to thank Senator Clark for bringing this bill forward. I noticed there are two projects in my district, one for Bi-County Cap in Bemidji and one for Pine River. I know the need is great. I know there's a waiting list right now for Head Start and other programs. We have, I don't know whether this is unique, but one thing that I think works really well in our area is that the Youth Build facility is located directly behind the Bi-County Cap building, which really helps for there to be a lot of interaction between a lot of the adults taking part in Youth Build have their children in those programs. We don't have the facility to be able to do the type of physical education that you were mentioning, Madam Chair, which would be great. During winter months, there is an outdoor play area, but just that proximity is really great. And that Youth Build program in Bemidji has been so extraordinarily successful.
Well, and I think that, you know, the key in the Rochester project was getting the parents and the children doing these things together, because then parents are modeling this behavior of being active, and oftentimes the parents need the activity as much as the children do. So it's a way of, you know, combining family time with also improving your health. Other questions? Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to Senator Clark for bringing this up. I always say that anybody that's been around me, and I know Eric has heard this statement before, that early childhood program in Fairmont saved my children and myself. So they started when they were 6 weeks old, and I've been very active in that program. It was probably one of the first ones. I think maybe actually Mankato was one of the first ones in the state, and I believe down there. But perhaps some of the other members around the table noticed that the funding on the wards are very, there's a deficit in southern Minnesota. And so I'm not sure they have a early childhood program, and it's very well established there, and there's certainly dire needs in that area. Why are we missing out on the awards? Is there some requirement?
And Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, you actually have to apply for these, so a community has to be either have a project that they are ready to go with. They actually go forward. They are the ones that are the impetus and saying that this is what the way they want to approach. I have to admit, when I've looked in the map in the past, one of the things that I get most excited about is how varied across the state. When I looked at it this morning, it's like, okay, we need a few more projects, like in Worthington and down in your area. So I think what you might want to do, frankly, is go back and talk to the folks in your district about coming forward. Frankly, the more requirements that are put on them, the more challenging it is for them. And this is a part. This is the other thing that we're looking forward in terms of as we move forward is the most any facility project can get right now in partnership with the state is $500,000. These are turning into be multi-million dollar entities or facilities. And so, you know, I think that may be the other piece. So my hope would be that they will be applying, because I can tell you that the departments have worked very closely with projects that come forward over time, but there's not unlike what happens with Minsky or the U of M, currently there is not a mechanism where the state can award some small amount of planning money that then they could use to come back and actually have a project. They really are having to figure this out on their own locally and then basically apply. So that's one of the improvements, along with Senator Berglund's recommendation, that we probably should be doing, because we know that those who are really being able to have some technical assistance may be able to pull this off better.
But there has never been a shortage of requests, without planning money being available.
That's right. So. But I am saying, Senator Berglund, is that could be one of the challenges, particularly if you're looking at the bigger dollars. And frankly, when there's only $500,000 available, a lot of entities don't apply that would like to, because you can't do many. And that's where the large appropriation really can make a difference, because if you are actually looking to build a facility and there's only $500,000 in the bonding that's available, there's not that, you know, your incentive just isn't very high to go forward. So hopefully we can work on that.
So, Madam Chair. Senator Clark, so in order, how does the application go through and the requirements that go through the Department of Human Services?
Yes, at this point in time, at one point it was the Department of Children, Family, and Learning. It's, you know, as we've evolved, every time there's changes made, but it's the Department of Human Services. They issue an RFP, and actually they're here if you have some specific questions for them. They are given some assistance on the RFP. Francie, do you want to come up? Francie Mathis is with the Department of Human Services. She in a former life ran a Head Start program, among other things, and has done a lot of work with communities on facilities. So one of the good things is they now have somebody who has direct local experience.
Madam Chair and Senators, Francie Mathis from the Department of Human Services, Office of Economic Opportunity, and we have a current RFP right now out, and we've had over 50 requests just coming to me that I've sent out, and I don't, of course, have an idea of how many responders have downloaded the RFP from the website. But there is a great deal of interest in this project.
And, you know, one of the things that I just think is so great about this is that, you know, projects that wouldn't be able to come to the state to ask for individual bonding can get help through this pool of money, projects all over the state. And, you know, we need to make sure that we aren't just thinking about all the big projects, that we think about some of these smaller efforts in communities that just wouldn't be able to go forward if they didn't have some way to apply for some money. Senator Rosen?
Well, I do have another question.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Ms. Mathis, do you have any historical background on why there is this huge deficit? Is it they did not meet the requirements, or they didn't know of this RFP, or it doesn't apply to them?
I believe it's just been a case of there hasn't been, the applications haven't come in. Because I have just recently gotten this grant back again to manage, but I did manage it back in the 90s as well. And at that time, we always would look at equitable distribution across the state of the applicants that applied. So it hasn't really been a case of inappropriate, projects, or it's just been, I think, a lack of applicants.
And I think it has had to do with the lack of funding
actually,
in this area.
Madam Chair, the other issue, and I'm going to let Mr. Nagel also say something about this, is, and I didn't say this before, I'm a big fan of Youth Build. It's a very important thing, and there are times where it works very well, but you're going to be getting another handout. You'll be able to see where Youth Build is located around the state. And just as you can see, Senator Rosen, there's not any Youth Build down there. And that, I think that requirement has made it more challenging for a number of places around the state. The one that was most recently canceled was it Manoman? The school district actually was having a hard time figuring out how to utilize Youth Build, and so they, instead of trying to work through a whole bunch of hoops, they decided to cancel the project, which is very unfortunate because I think that they probably, with some partnering areas, might have been able to figure that out. But that's why I think with good intention the Youth Build component was put in here. But it's very important that both on the Youth Build side, we're doing projects for the young adults that are working on them. They're appropriate for their level and their learning. They may not always be these projects. And two, if you don't have one existing, then you may be entirely missing out on the money. So that's where we're looking to be, as this is moving forward, modifying the language so that it really is more of a where feasible, that it's not a requirement, because otherwise I think that's been a part of the problem. I mean, otherwise you'd have to get somebody from the cities to come down right now and partner with you on that.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, and to Senator Rosen's point, I was working with an entity in my district, and frankly, one of the factors in why we might be seeing the skew that you're referencing is if you are kind of in the process of planning or trying to pull something together, while it's certainly, you know, Senator Berglund makes a very good point that this is a good source for some communities, it's not quite a big enough carrot to sort of get your project off the ground, perhaps, in some places. That's what I experienced in my district.
Because of the small amount of money that's been available most recently, but if we can get it back to where it used to be, I mean, it used to be $5 million, and of course, $5 million today isn't what it was, 8 years ago. But if we could even get it back to there, then I think, they can make bigger awards and they can have more projects. And there's just a lot more interest then around the state, and you get more applications.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
My concern is that everyone is getting all the correct information, and that that perhaps the guidelines can be brought into some of the programs that are in places and communities that don't specifically have a Youth Build program.
Right.
Have other,
I think that's what
that are,
she's indicated.
That's what I'm
so
hoping.
So I would
to
like, if possible, a list of the criteria for that Youth Build program. Early childhood is near and dear to these communities that, that need to hold on to their young people, and this is what attracts young families into the communities also. And so this is another carrot that we out in greater Minnesota can say, this is what we have for the young folk. We don't have a lot.
And Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I heartily agree with what you just said, and I want to reinforce that this has been incredibly important to a particular House member, and ultimately that's why it stayed in. But I think we're at a point that we can modify it a little bit and try to make it work.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, too, because Duluth is noticeably missing from here. And I'm not sure that I understand what Youth Build is. If it is just, it is a, is it something that's available to the whole state? Is it part of the early childhood family education program, or is it a program of developmental?
It's a program for teenagers to be involved in the construction and to learn construction skills, and it's an important thing to help our older youth have constructive activities and jobs, especially, you know, when you're in a soft economy, those are the ones that generally have more problems getting the summer jobs. And so these two things were linked. But, you know, I suppose another solution to the problem would be to get more resources to the Youth Build program, and then they could be...
Madam Chair, that's where I would go. I would say you'd want to have more there. And Mr. Nagel, because he's been pretty involved with that, I think it would be a good idea if he said... The other thing you should know is that largely it's young adults, young teenagers, older teenagers that have had other challenges in their life. So what they're trying to do is help give them both soft and hard skills, help them move forward. So there's some really good things that happen. But I think my recollection when I used to get to work on this in my previous life is that there was so limited funding at that time, and that this appeared to be a way to try to make sure that there was meaningful work opportunities for the people in those programs as well as keeping them alive. That's not what the primary focus of this grant project, though, is.
Oh, Madam Chair, members, if I could just comment. I was I worked up in Ottertail County for many years, and I was one of the partners when rural Minnesota SEP established their Youth Build program. And typically, they're partnered with alternative schools, and kids go to school half the day and work the other half of the day. And the fact that I had that experience that when we went to work for West Central and we went to build the project in Browns Valley, that, you know, just wasn't possible to bring a Youth Build program that far. And it was very difficult for me, who had had quite a bit of experience in three previous projects, and being a partner with the Youth Build program, it was hard for me to put it together. And the fact that the community and the other contractors that were working on the building weren't familiar with Youth Build at all, they didn't much like the idea of the kids working on the building, and it was difficult. And I imagine that's why the projects are pretty much housed. I'm not aware of any other project where they started a Youth Build program just to do the project like we did at West Central. The other thing, in the very small communities, it's hard to raise that kind of match money. You know, and we were lucky that the Sisseton Wahpeton Band, it was the first time they had made a contribution in Minnesota, donated $30,000 to the project, and West Central Initiative also donated considerable amount of money. Today, we couldn't do that project. Today, the $230,000 building would probably cost about $500,000, and we couldn't raise the local match, besides the Youth Build obstacle.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Senator Prettner-Solon's question, I visited our Youth Build program a couple of times during the interim, and actually, there are students there who I think the program goes through early 20s. I can't remember exactly what the cutoff is, but these are our students, or young adults, in their later teens and early 20s, who haven't been able to graduate from high school through other kinds of programs. And it's really designed as a transition, not so much to teach the skills for the building skills, although that's part of it, but to get them through education by paying them for the working part of this. And it's been very successful, not only in graduating students who have to meet very strict criteria to be a part of the program, and they have to be very dedicated to this, but it's really generated some leaders in areas in our community where students are more disadvantaged and haven't had those opportunities. We've seen some real leaders come out of this program. So I understand Senator Clark's concerns. But I would reiterate that this is the Youth Build program has been very successful, and if we can put more money there, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, Senator Holson, hopefully you've heard me say I really believe in Youth Build. It's incredibly important.
Any other questions about this project? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I still have an enormous amount of questions. Is this a nonprofit? Is it a Is that a government program? How widely known is it? How do you involve people, and how do other communities get involved?
Well, I'll start, Madam Chair, if that's okay, and then let Ms. Mathis speak, because it is done through the state. It's an RFP process because it is bonded. We only 1 year got cash. Cash was wonderful. There was a lot we could do in communities with cash because then you didn't necessarily have to have a public entity being the requester. And so a county, a city, or a school district has to be involved. There's been a lot of creativity, a lot of works with Parks and Recs. Yep, Parks and Recs. So they have to be a component of this. There is a lot of outreach that is done. Just about any place is told about this. So the barriers that you're seeing in some places or the reasons why are not related to that. They get help. They've got a time where they bring everybody together who's interested and talk about it. They're given some individual assistance in terms of if they have trouble with the application. But again, unless what I've found over the many years working related to this is that for a community to have a project that's ready to go, that can have the match, that can have everything, is a challenge. The smaller projects that you've seen in here, it has been very, it's one of those things from a greater Minnesota standpoint, part of the area we were just talking about excluded, that has been able to help many smaller communities that are looking for smaller projects. Those bigger ones, sometimes they don't want to go through all the requirements. They decide they don't need those funds. Some of the other bigger ones, though, frankly, it's what brings in the other money. It's what sets the table for the other partners coming together. Ms. Mathis, is there anything else that in terms of outreach or information you want to
share? Well, we do disseminate the notice of RFP widely. It's in the state register. It's on the DHS website. It goes to all the child care resource and referral network, the community action network, the Head Start programs.
School districts.
And because it's the GEO bond money, the building itself has to be owned by the political subdivision of the state. So generally it is the Head Start program or the child care program that says, oh, my gosh, here's some good money, and goes out and seeks out those collaborations. Most times the collaborations are in place, and they've been complaining about the building for a period of time. And so one of the entities or more get together, and that's how they put it together.
Thank you. Ironically, Madam Chair, it's one of those few times where you have maybe the local groups that are prodding the local government. You know, it's not, they're the ones, so almost you have to think of it as the process isn't even just that the local government units get access to this. It's the others that do that say, aha, now our time has come. We can do something.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you very much for having us, and hopefully we'll be able to do some good work.
Okay, members, I think that completes the review of the bonding projects. We're going to ask you to rank them, but I think we're going to wait and do that next week so you have a little bit of time to think about it and mull it over in your mind. We're going to give you five votes, so you'll vote 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and 5 is the highest. And then we'll just tally them up and send them on to Senator Langseth. I realize that's not very much considering the number of projects we've had, but we need to understand that not all the projects are going to be able to get fitted into the bonding bill. So this is just a way of indicating our priorities, and it doesn't mean that, you know, if you don't vote for a project, it doesn't mean it won't necessarily end up in the bonding bill. Makes it a little easier for us to tally if we don't have quite so many votes being cast. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on our tally sheet that has been prepared for us, there are a number of items within the Veterans Home proposal, each of them delineated on a separate line. So am I to understand that each of those represents, that's one priority or two priorities or three priorities? I'm always up for a challenge, Madam Chair.
And then what was it again? Number?
Number 5 would be our highest priority.
Your highest.
And then prioritize them from there down.
Mm-hmm. Because when we accumulate the votes, the higher the votes, the higher the project will be on the ranking.
And then minus one.
No, no.
Oh, okay.
If you vote for more, you're just, those won't be counted, that's all. Senator Lynch.
And Madam Chair, just so we're all clear on this, will you entertain, if I choose a particular item as a 1 through 5, there might be instances where one might suggest or prefer a different dollar amount, perhaps a lower dollar amount?
Yes, you can indicate that on your sheet if you want to.
All right, thank you.
Okay, well, we asked the folks from the Department of Veterans Affairs to stay so that they could give us a briefing on the latest violations at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. So we'll take that item next on our agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clark Dyrin, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Commissioner. Our Deputy Commissioner will be addressing specifically the complaint referred to. Before he starts, I would just like to summarize. I think, Madam Chair, you know well, but just to bring everyone up to speed, we are speaking specifically about the Minneapolis Veterans Home. The other veterans' homes are continue to do well. Just in the last month, Laverne and Silver Bay have passed their Department of Health inspections. So we are speaking specifically about Minneapolis. We are also specifically speaking about a problem that has been many years in existence. You had a hearing in August or September of 2005 when there were something like 30 correction orders at Minneapolis. Those had developed over a period of time. It was discovered that a nursing model had been changed for whatever reason. Nurse supervisors were done away with. So September of 2005, you had a hearing along with, I think, Senator Vickerman and your mother, Senator Lowry. Those committees, I was president of that one. I sadly would like to say that since 2005, nothing substantial had changed in the leadership. From 2005 forward, the then executive director was the acting administrator of the Minneapolis Home for about a year. Since that time, there have been...
We've had a number of changes of personnel.
Yes,
in the meantime.
And acting and interim. So that is a...
Hasn't always made any difference.
Right.
Let's just
and
put
so,
it that way.
So we are,
hope it will now, but...
And so we are coming to November of 19th when governance change. So some questions about what the Homes Board has said or whatever, we are not aware exactly of that. The governance was sharp. The governance change was sharp is what I'm trying to say. The executive order was effective November 19th. So we are now speaking about this time forward. Our deputy commissioner arrived on January 6th, and we would like to speak about what has happened. But in light of that, we just want to clarify that the governance model changed in November. And now I would like to turn it over to... Deputy Commissioner Gail Acevedo to continue specifically.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Gail Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner, Veterans Health. The Office of Health Facilities Complaint Investigation report that's dated January 15, 2008, addresses a medication error that occurred during October 9th of 2007. And the issue was that a licensed vocational nurse contacted a physician to seek information on or guidance on a resident that blood sugar was decreasing, and so the physician gave a telephone order and advised the licensed vocational nurse to reduce the dosage of the medication, the insulin, for a one-time dose change from 66 to 60. The licensed vocational nurse made the annotation on the physician's order sheet then went to the medication administration record and made an annotation on the medication administration record as well. A second nurse, as part of policies and procedures, went through to check the order, noted that the physician's order sheet in her interpretation was a one-time order change, reviewed the physician's order, noticed that it was a one-time order change, looked at the medication administration record, noted that it was also a one-time medication change, and co-signed that particular order. As part of policy and procedure, a third nurse, which is the nurse manager, reviewed the physician's order form and the medication administration record, noted and understood the order to read that it was a order change, not a one-time order change, and made the correction to the medication administration record. The resident went for a period of 9 days with a reduced medication change that was supposed to be a one-time correction. During this time, the nurse, the third nurse, which is the nurse manager, when she had a question about the particular order, whether it was a one-time or a continuous order change, did not make an effort to contact the physician for clarification, did not go back to the nurse that got the original order to verify what the intent of the order was, but made the correction to the medication administration record nonetheless. This was identified through a later audit that then resulted in an investigation. The investigation was conducted by the nurse manager, which is the third nurse that made the correction to the order. In her investigation, she found and felt that the order was written incorrectly by the first nurse and felt that it would be appropriate to correct or reprimand that particular nurse for the correction, for the mistake on the order as she interpreted. The information got to the administrator. The administrator then requested from the board for an investigation to be conducted by the board staff. Board staff came down to the veterans' home, conducted an investigation, and found that there were several errors in this. The first order that the LPN took initially in the physician's order was not as clearly stated as it could have been. The second nurse that looked at it understood what the first nurse put in there, and the third nurse made the change without checking with the physician, so there were multiple errors there. The other thing that we noticed in that is that a report to the common entry point reporting this medication error was not done. That was done at that time. The Office of Health Facilities Complaint came in, conducted their investigation, and found that the initial nurse that took the order did not write a clear enough order in the physician's order sheet, could have left interpretation for mistakes. The second nurse could have asked a question, asked for clarification, and the third nurse should not have made the correction to the medication administration record without verifying that with the physician. As a result, the Department of Health Services Office of Facility Complaint issued three orders, and under Minnesota rule, the three orders that were identified spoke to, one, the responsibilities of the Director of Nursing Services. Number two was medication errors. And number three was reporting of maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. Since then, we have had a change in some leadership, as Madam Chair alluded. We have a new director of nursing services. We have a new quality nurse, and our new director of nursing services has implemented some new procedures, such as re-education of nurses as far as it goes to medication treatment records. It also orders that are taken from physicians, transcription and checklists, and there are many multiple audits that are currently being put in place as well. The medication error. We have an implementation of 24-hour chart check that is reviewed by the night nurse. We're also doing a 10% random weekly audit for medication errors and any errors that we can possibly identify based on all the orders. In January 2008, we now audit all orders weekly, and we also have the director of nursing deeply involved in all aspects of the medication orders and or the training of our nurses. Under the maltreatment of the reporting of maltreatment of a vulnerable adult, we have reviewed our policies and procedures, reviewed the comment entry point prerequisites. We have a spreadsheet that breaks down what is reportable, what would not be reportable. At the central office, we now have a quality assurance nurse as well. We're working on a quality assurance committee to look at areas that can be identified as common high-risk areas, such as falls, medication errors, and we're tracking that, and we're going to start measuring those types of things to state averages, other veterans' homes, and national averages. We're also looking at ways to develop best practice to not only educate the staff, but take procedures that are working in other facilities and put them in place at our facility.
So over what period of time did this communication gap between all these nurses that were involved with this diabetic patient take place? I mean, the order was for a one-day change. How many days was the communication taking place over?
Madam Chair, it was a period of 9 days.
I know it was 9 days that the resident had the wrong medication administered to them, but what was the period of time that the nurses involved in the decisions about this medication were communicating with each other?
Madam Chair, if I may, I have the interim administrator here for the Minneapolis home as well, so I can get an exact answer.
Until the 20th of October, so it was 11 days.
I'm sorry?
11 days. 11 days before they saw clarification.
I think the question is, how long were they talking about it before?
It was actually 11 days before clarification was sought, and they were discussing it the whole time. And then I noticed that there was a problem, and it called a team meeting, and actually reinstated to them that they needed a clarification order, and that occurred on, let's see, 31st. But what I found out retrospectively, because I wasn't being updated accurately, that there actually was a one of our officers of the day had sought clarification on the 20th, but still the investigative team at Minneapolis did not see that as an incident and self-report, and that's why we ordered an investigation to come through the board office because of the ability to be confident in the outcome. Does that help? So it was on the 20th when they sought clarification. They still were discussing it as a team, and it was not until the 29th when I actually called them together that we actually got them to see their investigation was flawed.
Well, it just creates a question in my own mind as to whether it's even possible in that facility to change a medication order for one day, if it takes 11 days to talk about it.
Madam Chair, I think part of the investigation from the Office of Health Facilities Complaints, part of the what they identified in the investigation was that the person that did the initial investigation was the nurse that made the change and did not feel that this was reportable. So that might have slowed down some of the investigation process as well, because she was deeply involved in that whole right. medication error.
Well, it doesn't seem appropriate to me that someone be investigating their own activities if there's a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you state your name for the record, ma'am, just in case
Carol anybody... Gilbertson, the interim administrator of Minneapolis.
Thank you. I also was concerned about what disciplinary action might have been taken in regard to these nurses. You know, the original nurse might have written it clearer, but she did try to write down the correct order. So it seemed to me like it was a supervising nurse that made the biggest error, and I'm concerned that the other nurses not receive undue harsh discipline for someone else's mistake.
Madam Chair, I'll let Ms. Gilbertson address that. Just for the record, the supervising nurse or the managing nurse is no longer a managing nurse with that particular facility. And you're absolutely correct. In the investigation, it was noted that there was an attempt to correct or reprimand the nurse that made the initial transcription, when it could have been an education at that point. But the biggest error that is identified came from that nurse manager. And I'll let the interim administrator explain what actions were taken at that point.
Madam Chair, actually, what brought it to my attention was exactly what you're talking about, is that it appeared from the people that were reporting to me that we were not fairly investigating all parties involved. And we now have the RN manager works in a different area. She's not managing anybody, as Gil stated. We did retrain everybody. We did only really have one nurse that had received disciplinary action at the time it came to my attention. And when I met with them on the 29th, that was one of my points. My first point was they needed to clarify the order from all three parties should have sought it. My second point was that we fairly needed to investigate and retrain everyone equally, and that all three parties were involved in the clarification order. And let's see what else. We have further looked at, we've spoken with OHFC about doing some on-site training to assist us with a better investigation process. And currently we're exploring having one investigative nurse for compliance, so we no longer have this happen in the future, so we can have unbiased, fair approaches. And they would report to me.
There are other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if when this problem was being discussed with the nurses, other than, you know, acknowledging that things should have been done differently, which I'm sure occurred, I wonder if were any rationale or reasons given why this happened. For example, are there difficulties communicating between physicians and nurses? Was there any input from the nurses in their defense? So that's one question I have. And another question I have, I haven't worked with a hospital in a legal capacity for a long time, but many years ago when I was in the Air Force, I was an advisor to a regional hospital's quality assurance committee. And when things like this would happen, they would always not just be looked at in a vacuum in terms of the people involved, but they would be brought to the quality assurance committee and looked at more systemically. And I wonder if there's that kind of thing happening in these types of situations.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, in fact, the communication was between nurse to nurse. They were not openly communicating and answering to that question. They were not listening to the first and second nurse. The third nurse was not sitting down and looking at the order objectively. So I totally agree it was a communication problem. And in regards to quality assurance, we did put all of our med errors. We took a three-month look back and put them into an aggregate RCA process, root cause analysis, to take a critical look at what's gone on with our medication problem within the facility. And we had that done by our previous medical director, Dr. Zimmer. She leads the whole root cause analysis process, and she's the one that developed that, and that's been completed recently.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dilbertson, you've indicated that there have been some improvements made in some staffing adjustments or changes made. Previously, when you have appeared here, you have noted staffing challenges and vacancies, and this seems like it might be an appropriate time for you to just indicate to us, have you made some gains there, and what's your current staffing situation is generally with regard to nursing?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch and committee members, yes, in my opinion, the staffing challenges for Minneapolis really have to do with broken systems, including within the staffing office, not having the right people sitting in the right positions that have the depth of knowledge that we need to identify problems quickly. We have recently hired a staffing person with great accounting background, computer skills, and staffing skills, and we are all already seeing significant improvements within that department and good leadership and good communication, so that it's not a negative outcome, it's a positive outcome. Through that, we have met with our HR staff and started partnering up. We have a new HR person also, and we're partnering with them and cleaning up that whole process and looking at position control rosters. The real problems, we lose about 8 to 9 HSTs a month looking at our turnover rate. And in the way the state system comes together and the way we post things, we really need to be hiring about 18 a month. We have applications. We just have not had the right people doing the right thing at the right time. And we have that happening now. And that was an important change. And part of that's based on that we've had so many people helping us that it's been difficult to really lead a lot of things that need to be led through from me out and to help facilitate team, and we really are seeing significant gains at this time.
Thank you.
So what is your vacancy rate?
Vacancy rate right at this time?
HSTs and for nurses.
Do you mind if I let Nancy Dell speak to that?
That's fine.
Madam Chair, committee, we have currently we have 10 RN vacancies at Minneapolis, and we have 13 vacancies in human service technicians or nursing assistants. Keep in mind that those are not all full-time equivalents, so that they may be half times, so that we can account and allow for each one of our nursing assistants or nurses to have every other weekend off, based on the contract language.
So what is it in terms of full-time equivalence?
Full-time equivalence, it is, for RNs, it's actually 6, and for HSTs, it's 10, for a total of 16 FTEs.
And how does that compare with your previous vacancy rate?
It's about the same. It continues to be about the same. One of the things that I would tell you that in the last 2 weeks, we've had an opportunity to have some discussion with the MHHA and also with the Department of Labor and Industry, and some discussion about partnering with them with an apprenticeship program that would actually allow us to bring people in. We were also looking at the number of returning Iraqi vets who are looking for job placement, and there is GI money there for education, and there is a connection between the apprenticeship program and the GI funding, which would allow us to bring people in through the returning vets and through the community in separate funding sources and have them articulate through, and they would actually start out as it's a universal program that's going statewide. They would actually get experience in housekeeping, food service worker. If they are not currently a high school graduate, it would give them the opportunity to get their GED or equivalency. They would then be able to go on for the CNA or the Certified Nursing Assistant Program, and then MNSCU is involved, which would allow them to articulate into the LPN program and the RN program. And it is definitely a plan that we're excited about because, as all of you know that have been involved in healthcare, we are facing a serious shortage of healthcare workers at a time when we have the largest increasing senior population or population that may be needing care. Those programs will actually be, there's a pilot program currently in Kansas, and there is availability, and they are looking for people to partner with them in the state of Minnesota.
Are you able at this point in time to say that you are staffing based on acuity of the patients in the Minneapolis home?
Madam Chair, did you want Ms. Dahl to state her name for the record, and then I'll have Ms. Gilbertson.
Yes, please do that.
I'm sorry, Nancy Dahl, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, we are staffing by acuity, and I had prepared something to talk about. Now, acuity staffing models are used in the Minnesota state, used to use a 0.95 ratio. I don't know if you're familiar with all that. And Minnesota kind of laid that away a few years back because it really didn't work. But when we look at acuity standards for Minneapolis, that would call for staffing about 2.66 nursing hours to 2.76 nursing hours of care per day. But what I have done is looked at the Minnesota Quality Initiative, that five-star facilities that Minnesota is looking at for rating their private sector. And so we're staffing at 4.07 to 4.447 nursing hours per day per standardized day. And to get to a five-facility standard per Minnesota standards with all direct care people, we'd be looking at staffing from 5.57 to 7.99 direct care hours per day. So what we're looking at in Minneapolis is to become a five-star facility. So we are not quite double, we're 30% higher than what an acuity model would call for. And so while we have vacancies, we are having some people choose overtime, we're not mandating, and we do staff almost all the time what we say we're going to staff on the units. Just the other day, I had an HSD come up and thank me for the good job that we're doing with the staffing and what a difference it makes. So we're working hard to really turn that around.
So what would be the range of staffing hours then among the patients at the Minneapolis home?
It would be 4.07 care hours to 4.47 care hours per resident per day. And then if you look at the federal guidelines, they noted to be about 4.08 to be a considered standard. And so we're trying to target right within that, also looking at the state of Minnesota's quality initiative.
All right, I'm going to say this differently. What is the lowest number of hours per patient that is provided to any resident, and what is the highest number of nursing hours per resident?
That was the range I gave you, but I can restate it, Madam Chair. 4.07 is the lowest that we are currently staffing per resident per day.
And what is the highest?
4.47.
Well, that doesn't seem to me that it's much of a range.
Maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Well, you have low need residents and you have high need residents.
Oh, yes. Our case mix range is relatively close, and that's probably partly why that is, because our acuity scores are calling for about 2.66 to 2.76, and that's probably why the range is fairly narrow. I do have graphs on that also if you want to see them.
Well, you do have 61 domiciliary beds.
Oh, I'm not, excuse me, Madam Chair, I was only speaking to the skilled care.
Okay. What is the staffing level for the domiciliary beds?
I would have to obtain that data for you. I didn't know that you were looking at that. I'm sorry.
Well, if you could get that, I think that would be helpful. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm interested in going back to something that you said earlier about the analysis that occurred after the medication error and the review that you referred to for your quality assurance process that did root cause analysis. Can you tell me who participates in that process and what the outcome was? What was determined as the root cause analysis? Is there a recommendation for change? And is there redundancy built in the process to impact not just this, but all the processes related to medication?
Madam Chair and committee members, I didn't bring that whole root cause analysis with me, but what I can tell you is it is an interdisciplinary team. Our Dr. Zimmer, who was our previous medical director, chairs it. That's to bring the standard to a higher level. It's not required, but she chairs that. Then we have the DON, the ADONs, different various sectors of nursing, different other supportive staff, like we from therapy to different departments to help give different perspectives.
Pharmacy,
absolutely. A pharmacist. We have a new pharmacist there. And out of that root cause analysis, we determined to make a number of pharmacy changes, and we're working at that, at getting some bubble packs with unit dosing, which is more like the private sector. And so we've already been looking at new med carts, and so we'll be ordering new med carts to accommodate that whole system. And this is off the top of my head, so I apologize. There's like four or five things in pharmacy that we'll be doing. I can't name them all, but they're to make the system simpler for nurses, to decrease your ability to have an error, and then in combination a number of the things that Gil has already stated, and the other items I can't recite off the top of my head.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think that from the last time we had meetings, we talked about whether or not you were instituting quality assurance initiatives that would do root cause analysis and doing an analysis in that. Without that, you're guessing at what the difficulty is, and you're not building in a solution that has built into the solution a redundancy so that it doesn't fall apart again just as soon as somebody changes or you have the turnover rates that you have, that's not impacted then as much by that turnover rate.
Madam Chair, Senator, the home went through just recently a training with the United States Department of Veteran Affairs on the root cause analysis process. The United States Department of Veteran Affairs, their hospitals have a really phenomenal root cause process that takes a whole team effort to do exactly what you're saying, ma'am. It really brings out the different eyes looking at things and looking at what was the root cause and then now what do we need to do to fix it to prevent it from happening again. And oftentimes a lot of redundancies are identified and or very basic communication errors come out of the root cause as well. So right now we are currently doing that. We've gone through. We're still training more and more staff to do that, but it is truly an interdisciplinary team process.
Madam Chair and committee members, I can give you a couple more things that we're doing. In the pharmacy part, we're looking at new software that'll make it a little bit more for enhanced accuracy and for new medical records, the MARs that the nurses use to enhance the ease of usability for the nurse.
And what is the status of the skin care at the facility? That's been an area of ongoing problem.
I'm looking for a report. I apologize for that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, while Ms. Gilbertson is looking for the report, I'll also like to mention that part of the stipulation with the Department of Health that we do have Pathways, which is a consulting firm to do monitoring at the home, and they're doing continuous monitoring there. We have some guidelines from the Department of Health as well that is a plan of action that we're using as a roadmap that is helping us identify issues and put systems in place. So the as part of the stipulation and the Pathways consulting group, we're making strides in that area as well.
Senator, the Pathways came to the facility on December 10th and did pretty much a month-long initial survey, baseline survey. So the timing proved fortuitous as he begins his work. They are completing a baseline survey, so there are some identifications of systems that may be broken, something in writing, basically, as we go forward.
Well, did you find it?
Madam Chair and committee members, I did bring our CHESRA data because I thought maybe you would ask me about our skin. In our skin pressure area, our high-risk clients fall within our peer groups or lower, so we're doing really well in that area. In our low-risk residents, though, we continue to flag a little bit higher, so that needs further exploration. We flag at 68% in that group, which doesn't maybe totally have meaning for you, but we show on our quality report, and there's like 12 areas that are looked at, 3 flags, which is really significant improvement for Minneapolis. In our toileting plans, which have a big effect on skin care, we've gone from historically being relatively high down where you can see on the graph, if you can see that far, that we've come down into the range of our peers and within the median and the high and low range also. So we continue to focus on that area.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope this isn't too far off the subject, but I'm just wondering, based on the testimony that was given from Ms. Gilbert, is it Gilbertson? More generally, and really just to help my understanding, if I'm sure you know, Madam Chair, when she was talking about staffing levels and acuity standards, I thought I understood her to say that they were above the Minnesota acuity standards at 2.66 or something like that, but they were, and they were seeking to be, or they were at the national average standard of 4-point-something. Does Minnesota have a lower requirement in terms of staffing nursing homes than the average national standard? Or maybe I was misunderstanding the testimony.
We have a minimum number of hours that are required in statute, which I would say is fairly dated. Is a minimum, however. And so, you know, the range of needs of people within nursing facilities in Minnesota have changed quite dramatically, I would say, even over the last 8 years. We have much shorter stays, much higher acuity levels. But that's not to say that there are not some people in a nursing facility that have lower acuity needs. So it's a minimum level that's in the statute, and I would say that most facilities need to and do staff at higher levels than the minimum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess that just stood out to me because I know that nursing homes in our area are having a hard time with, you know, the level of staffing and the requirements that the staff have in terms of their responsibilities. And so I just wondered where we stood nationally or if anyone's looked at that.
Well, I certainly don't have that information at the tip of my fingers. You might want to inquire through the Department of Health about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a quick statement. I hope you'll give me that latitude. I've served for the last almost 6 years on the Veterans Affairs Committee, Senator Vickerman's, and I've gotten to know Commissioner Dyrud, and I want to tell you that nobody cares more about veterans than Commissioner Dyrud, and he is trying to do the best job he can. And I would say to this committee that, you know, I know how passionate everybody on this committee is, and we want to make sure that the veterans' nursing homes are doing the right things. But I would point out the fact that the brand new commissioner has just come on board, and we need to give him a little latitude to get things in line and in order. And I have the utmost confidence in him, and I have all the confidence in the world in Commissioner Dyrud. And so I hope that we, even though, you know, obviously we have oversight over this, I hope that we'll give them a little latitude, give them time to try to get things going in the right direction. And then if they're not, then we can be critical of them. But I hope that we, you know, in a way, and I might be wrong, but I feel like we're being a little bit critical today. And I hope I'm wrong, but I just want to say that I know they're trying to get it together. So anyway, I just want to leave it at that. So I hope we'll give them a little latitude, and I know that they're going to do all they can to try to get things going in the right direction. So thank you.
Well, Senator Coring, I'm sure that you're right. I also believe that everybody else who's preceded them cared very deeply about veterans. So I believe that many of the problems that we have at the Minneapolis Home are systemic, not due to an individual mm-hmm. who necessarily was not caring enough. And that's why we keep asking them to come back, and that's why we keep asking them to tell us how they're changing things there, so that we can make sure that they understand that we want them to keep on track.
And Madam
and
Chair,
it isn't meant to be critical, but our constituents hold us accountable, and therefore we have to hold the people who work at the Minneapolis Home accountable.
Exactly.
Are there other questions? I'm glad to hear that you're doing better. Keep up the work. And, you know, I know that it's making a change is challenging. Continuing to make the change is even more challenging. So we wish you well in that effort. I guess with that, then the meeting will be adjourned.